Cue Henry Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome you to the 243rd episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recording for the previous 242 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C, so that's www.johnmack13.com. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day. And it's free. Once again, www.johnmack13.com. Next Sunday, I hope you'll be with us then. But my guest is author Sarah Bracy White. And every Sunday for this year's season. Before going any further, an announcement. Writers and poets in the upper Westchester Putnam area may wish to participate in some of the terrific writing groups in the area. The Mayapack Writers Group, now in its 21st year under the coordination of Vinnie DeQuino, meets every Thursday evening at 6:30 in the Mayapack Library on 6th in Mayapack, New York. There are also two poetry workshops in the area. The first meeting on the second Wednesday of each month at 6:30 at the same Mayapack Library. Although this month it is being held on the third Wednesday, which is this Wednesday, August 15th. And the second on the fourth Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. at the John C. Hart Library in Shrub Oak, New York. The next Shrub Oak meeting is Wednesday, August 22nd. People wishing more information on any of these may contact me at johnmack13@gmail.com. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. Now, to this week's show, as mentioned, the 243rd in this series, my guest is Annette Oliver Shabbs. I first met Annette on July 21st of this year when the John C. Hart Library in Shrub Oak held a meet author session on this Saturday afternoon, and we got talking about to writing. Since then, Annette has joined the aforementioned local writers group and poetry workshops, and I've gotten to know her much better and become familiar with her background and accomplishments. Briefly, Annette, a woman of color, found and fought with the help of her parents racism and discrimination, even as a very young child. All through her life as a writer, college professor, and administrative high school teacher, and is even an assistant pastor of the New York City Church, she has continued this fight. And along the way, she has picked up a bachelor's degree, two masters, separated by 31 years, and a PhD. So we have a lot to talk about. the listeners wishing to join Danette and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I generally hold call participation until near the end of my conversation with my guest. Let's get started. Welcome to the show, Annette.
Thank you very much.
In earlier conversation, the notes to me, you had mentioned a few of the activities of your father, the Methodist minister, in responding to discrimination, which I'm sure provided the framework for your later activities. Would you tell us about the incident in Kentucky and also his activity in Washington, D.C.?
Really, when we were in Kentucky, there was a group of civic women who had a civic organization, and they had purchased a refrigerated water fountain for the colored school. The schools were segregated, and one of the things, this was before air conditioning, so the greatest thing you could do in those hot days was to get a nice cool glass of water or drink of water, and they had purchased a refrigerated water fountain for the colored school. And one day when the white superintendent came to the school, colored school, he saw the water fountain, and he had it taken out and placed in the white school. Well, many of the women were members of the church where my father pastored, and they came to my father and said, oh, this is not right. This is wrong. That's wrong. We want our water fountain back. That was wrong. They can't just take it. We pay for it, and so forth and so on. So then there were other members in the church who were saying, oh, that's just the way it is down here. You can't do anything about it. If we try to do anything about it, there'll be trouble, and we don't want any trouble. So my father decided he would try to do something about it. And he did. He was able to do something about it. So that, and what he did was to go and talk to the white superintendent and talk about how expensive it was to have a segregated school system, because you needed two of everything. And he broached the subject like that, that you know that they needed two of everything, and he just talked to the man about what it meant to have a segregated system. Well, you can't have one, you have to have two, because that's the way it's set up. And so he, I guess, got the man to understand that he should bring the refrigerated water fountain back to the colored school, and in a couple of weeks it was back, and there was no trouble. Nobody lost jobs, and that was what they thought would happen, that there would lose jobs and things like that would happen in retaliation, but it was handled so that there was no trouble, and the people were very happy about that. And so his ministry, what I'm saying is his ministry was very much defined by the problems that his congregation, members of his congregation brought to him. There was a time he had to be a lawyer sometimes when they when his members needed a lawyer. I remember he and my mother going to defend a person, a young man who had been in an automobile accident, and there was a death. And he was able to work that out for that family. And then I think one of the more serious, I shouldn't say more serious, but one that took a lot of his time was the one when one of his members came to him, and that was in Indiana, because her son, who had finished college and done very well, who was a very good student, was not able to get a job in the community in which we live. He had to go to Cleveland, Ohio at the time to get a job. They were in his area. Now, if he wanted a job as a janitor, I'm sure he could have gotten that, but he wanted a job that went along with his schooling. And in order to do that, he couldn't do it unless he went to another state. And the mother was so torn up about having her son leave and not being able to live in the community and where she could help him and he could perhaps have some of what she had, she and her husband had amassed. So that became a big war. After she was so upset about it, my mother encouraged my father to do whatever he could to do about it, and he did take several trips to Washington to see about job discrimination and getting employment there in the community in which we live, and that was at that was in Muncie, Indiana, I believe. And soon there were a lot of
I also know that your mother decided that you and your brother would not grow up in the segregated South and uprooted you for early grammar school years. Would you tell us about that experience?
Well, my father was a minister, and his most of his charges, the churches that he was pastoring, were in the South. And my mother feared that we would not get proper health care. And in the segregated South, she feared that we would be bleeding to death, have some kind of accident, and wouldn't be able to get the health care from the doctor because of the segregation or having to wait until everybody left the office who might not be seriously ill and we would be perhaps even bleeding to death. So we stayed a lot in the north with my brother's mother until my mother kept encouraging my father to try to get out of the South, because that was her fear of going being in the South, not having adequate health care at a very critical time. We might have to go to the doctor, we might be sick, and definitely so, but we wouldn't get the health care that we needed, medical attention.
Coincidentally, you later taught in Mount Vernon, where your mother had moved during that time. But that's getting ahead of the story. Do you remember your earliest aspiration as a child?
My earliest aspiration?
Yes.
I don't. As a child, I just loved being around my parents quite a bit. I think I did like to the idea of, you want to be grown up. But later on, I wanted to be a, by the time I was in high school, I wanted to be a UN interpreter and travel and speak different languages and understand what people were saying when they were speaking different languages. That was one of the things I wanted to do growing up in high school, and I didn't.
Go ahead.
I didn't pursue that because I think because my mother did not want me to be out of the country. So I guess she thought there would be some bad medical situations as well in some of the third world countries. And I am sure that there would have been. I probably would have had some ailments that I would be living with now if I had pursued that. So she got my father to talk me out of wanting to go to be a UN interpreter, which he did.
When your father was transferred to a posting in Illinois with integrated schools, your family was reunited. But even there, and later in Indiana, you found both discrimination and teachers that assumed as a black child your intelligence was inferior to your white classmates, and obviously there wasn't. How were you able to handle that as a child?
Well, I could sense that I think I can remember one time in Indiana. It was my very first day in an English class, the teacher had separated the classrooms. I mean, the classroom, so that she had divided it, even though we were integrated, supposedly. She, in her mind, had really divided it. And there were two rows of students who were supposed to be slow and two rows of students who were supposed to be very good students. And my first day, I didn't realize this until I started raising my hand and she wouldn't let me answer any of the questions when she was talking to the students on the other side of the room. And I could sense after that that she had already divided the room. Now, I didn't know this just walking in. She assigned me a seat. But after a while, when she wouldn't let me answer any of the questions she was asking on the other side of the room, I was able to figure it out. And so I told her that what I could surmise, and I think she was kind of stunned that I could surmise it so quickly. And so I told her I belonged on the other side of the room because she had divided the room on one smart with a smart on one side and the dumb on the other side, and she put me on the dumb side. That was my language at the time. I probably could have used different words, but at that time, that's what I said. And so she put me on the other side of the room in the very back, and then she proceeded to give an unannounced quiz. And I think that quiz was to show me that you don't know what you think you know. And so she gave the quiz, and we had to exchange papers, and then she would call the roll, and we had to tell the paper. She gave the answers, and we had to mark them right or wrong and do the arithmetic to divide them from, subtract from 100 to get the score. And so it happened that I got the highest grade and on the quiz. So she had to look at my paper, and she came and looked at my paper and looked at everybody's paper near mine, everybody's paper who was sitting near me, and satisfied herself, I suppose, that I hadn't cheated. And then she made me move to the front of the classroom and sit in the front seat. And then later that afternoon, she gave me my first job, which was to grade papers. Now, I didn't expect any of that to happen, but that's the way it happened, and she gave me my first job. And I graded papers for her, and she gave me $1 a week for grading papers all year. And so I had my first job.
So you may have changed that whole woman's perception just by you being willing to stand up for your own intelligence.
I suppose I did.
How old were you then?
I was a seventh grader.
Okay.
In seventh grade.
You also had a point that there was the teacher who was going to drive to Mexico, and your parents had some concern about going through the deep south and not being able to get to eat or to do anything. Tell us about your Mexican trip.
Okay. My teacher announced that he was going to drive to Mexico over spring break, and that if any of us wanted to drive along with him, ride along with him, he would take us in the car if our grades were so and so, and he would take us down with him to Mexico. So I went home and I told my parents I wanted to go and what was going on. So my father talked to the teacher and asked him what did he propose to do? How did he propose to deal with segregation while I'm in the car and he's driving to Mexico through southern states? And his way of handling the situation didn't really suit well with my parents because he said, well, I would just have to stay in the car. I would be welcome to ride along with them, and when we got to the segregated places where I couldn't go in, I would just tell them what I wanted, and they would bring me the food, but I would be in the car and blah, blah, blah. So that didn't work well with either. I think then my parents were determined that I was going to go, but I wasn't going to have to deal with the indignities of racism. So what happened was that my parents, my father had the teacher to agree to meet me at the railroad station in Mexico. And my father and my mother had got me a train ticket to go south to Mexico, go to Mexico. And so I traveled by train rather than by car with the teacher. And traveling by train meant that my parents got me a berth so that when we crossed the Mason-Dixon line, we wouldn't have to change cars or anything like that. So when we got a berth, that meant we could stay in the berth. There was a bath and a shower. There was a bed and a bath in there. And we didn't have to come out. And my parents told us, don't come out. My father said, don't come out. Don't come out. He told us, don't even look out the window. He said, close the windows. He didn't want anyone seeing us through the windows and throwing rocks at us or what have you. So we kept the windows closed, the blinds closed, and they found someone for me to travel with. I had a classmate, a young girl who was also a Spanish student, and we, her father and mother consented for us to travel together, and we traveled in this berth all the way to Mexico from when we first got on the train in Indiana all the way to Texas. I think we had to change in Texas. But we didn't have to deal with segregation because the porters brought us our food and our drinks and everything else. The porters were people of color, and they took very good care of us.
You mentioned in your note to me that when you were in Mexico that you found no discrimination. Maybe there was economic classes because of we hear about poverty in Mexico. Now I've been there, but there wasn't any racial discrimination. Was that surprising to you after you went through all of this stuff in your own country?
Well, you know, I really didn't realize it until I got back to this country. I realized that I had a prejudice-free experience in Mexico, but I didn't feel the everything that dropped off until I got back. Then it came right back on me. When I came back to the States, I realized I'd been away from the prejudices and the color consciousness, and that comes with the prejudice that comes with color consciousness. It was like a sheet or a web came over me to trap me. That was the sensation I got when I got back in the States. I'd been back in the States a couple of days, and it came wham right back to me just like that. And then I realized what it was. It was this experience that had to do with racism.
If you look back in those days of what you had to go through in various places as a child and an adolescent, do you feel that made you stronger or it scarred you, or it was just an experience that you're able to look back on now and to realize that we've come a long way, but we still have a long way to go? I mean, what's its impact on you now when you think back at those days?
I don't feel scarred. I feel... my home was a wonderful place. Home was just this wonderful place where even if things were bad on the outside, when you got home, my parents made home such a wonderful, wonderful place. I felt invincible when I was leaving home. You know, whatever problems came, I was able to deal with them. That's what home was like, and I appreciated that. No problems actually were insurmountable once we got. It was like a refueling station, and everything was okay after you got home, and there was no one there who's going to hurt you or anything like that at home. So home was this place where you could go and come out. And no, I don't feel that I feel enriched because I had battles that I had to deal with, and that made me more of a warrior, I believe, and more cognizant of some of the things that happen today that are kind of inventions or remodels of what happened before. It's just that it might take a little different form or a little different, and it's not really that different because I've dealt with it before. I've seen it before, and not that I've seen everything, but I've had experiences that shape what I see, help me color what I'm seeing now.
Okay. And then it was off to Ball State University. What were your college years like?
They were good. I was invited to join the Honor Society, Honor Society on campus, which I did not do. I joined a sorority instead. And I probably should have gone with the Honor Society, but I didn't. But they were good. But again, they were prejudiced. But I think I didn't really always realize it a lot of times. For example, when we went to Woolworths for lunch, if we didn't have lunch at school, we would go out into the community. And I mean, this is going back, not college, but back to high school. There was a Woolworths, and there was a section where we would go to get hot dogs, and we would stand there and eat hot dogs. Well, every once in a while, I decided to go to the luncheon counter where the stools were and sit down. And I really didn't realize I wasn't supposed to be there. But until I looked back and I said, oh, that's why things happened as they did. There would be nobody there. And I would always get me a strawberry ice cream soda. That's what I would go to the fountain to get there in Woolworths. And when the young lady who was there waiting on, I guess the waitress there, she would fix my strawberry soda. As soon as she saw me coming, I didn't even have to ask for it. And I thought, oh, this is so wonderful. I don't even have to ask. She knows exactly what I want, and she has it ready for me right away. But she was getting me out of the way for the rush. And as she served me, she had no problem serving me, but I guess my timing was such that I came, like I said, the counter would be empty, and I guess it was just before the big crowd came in. And she would hurry up and get me an ice cream soda, and I would hurry up and finish it, not thinking that that's why I was I was being served so readily. But anyway, that's what happened. But I look back and I see, oh, I really wasn't supposed to be there, but I didn't have any consequences from being there, any negative consequences. That's the way it worked out. She served me. I got out of the way. I was going back to school before the people came to sit there. And had they come when I was there, then there might have been a problem. But the problem never presented itself because I was usually out of the area before anybody came.
What did you major in at college?
Oh, I switched majors. I was an art major initially. And then I left art because even though I loved it, it was very, very expensive because I had to have a project every week and I had to buy all of my supplies. And I think it was more expensive than buying books, you know, the new books that we had to read or the books that we had to read. So I had to buy all of these supplies, but I enjoyed it. But so after a while, I didn't like spending so much money on projects. And so even though I had wonderful projects. And then I think I switched to psychology. And I enjoyed psychology. And I think I left that because I was disillusioned with statistics, how people could twist the statistics around to say whatever they wanted to say. And that kind of disillusioned me, how you could, you know, just kind of almost tell untruth or prove things that weren't really true in a way. So I felt, and so I left that. And then I think I went from statistics to foreign languages, French and Spanish. And then I left French and Spanish because I realized that if I switched over to English, I could finish school earlier. I would get out early. I would didn't have as many credits to take, so I ended up being an English major. And that's
did you get all that done in 4 years, all this changing a major?
Oh, yeah, I got it done in, I think, 3.5 years, or three and a half years, because I finished early. I finished early from college.
And then you came to New York. What brought on that move?
Well, my parents were going to be transferred from where we were, so I wasn't going to stay there. I wanted to go to Washington, D.C., but after several news articles, my mother became aware of certain things in Washington, D.C. that she didn't feel comfortable with. So I ended up she told me I could come to New York. I knew she never really said no, but I knew I wasn't going to Washington anymore. Initially, she had found me a roommate, and whose parents she knew there to go to Washington, who also wanted to go to Washington, D.C. And we were going to be roommates, and this roommate particularly had a big brother, 5 years older, who was going to be like our bodyguard, and he was going to be living nearby, and he would protect both of us. But after a while, my mother said I was going to New York, and I did go to New York, and I stayed with her aunt, who was a seamstress, and she made me everything. She made me coats. She made me suits. She made me dresses. So that was a nice experience.
I know that you taught both grammar school and high school, and then while teaching, to continue along the academic path, first at Columbia and then NYU. What were you studying then?
At Columbia, I was majoring in education courses, I believe, and political and educational courses. And at NYU, I was dealing with they had a wonderful program for what they call Saturday at the Square, which I enjoyed, and that was in the arts. That was mostly in the arts. But I had to take, I think, English exams to get into that program.
Where did you meet the famous Gwendolyn Brooks?
Well, that was a wonderful experience. I think I met her when she came to New York to City College. And I knew she was coming, so I decided to get in her class. And that was a very great experience. She's a great person, wonderful person.
She seems to have had a major impact on your life, both personal and professional. Am I correct in this opinion?
Well, she would invite me whenever she came to New York. She was a Chicago person, but when she came to teach, she would stay in the hotel. And she would have me come to the hotel room with her, and we would talk half the night, and I would catch the train back to Mount Vernon, the last train. And then she would also have me go out to invite me out when she went out with her her agent, you know, and she really almost gave me her agent all over to do my poetry and to go on tours. So she was great. She was very supportive. And I know she had a whole following of young people in Chicago. And I think wherever she went, she was very wonderful. She even invited me and my husband to Christmas with her one year.
Please tell us about your dissertation.
My dissertation. Oh, okay. I wrote an adaptation of Richard Wright's autobiography for my dissertation, and It was a play. I wrote it as a play, a stage drama, and of his life. And my mother was my agent, so to speak, and so she got it. She got me to have the producers from ABC to accept my play. She was very out there for me, so she was. I had such wonderful parents. They were there for me all along, and she made sure that I got an opportunity to have it. She did everything she had to do as an agent. I couldn't have had a better agent.
And was it done on television?
It was accepted, and they wanted it, and I said no. Which I later regretted.
Now, you mentioned your husband, so you were married at the time.
Yes.
Okay. You've been involved in college teaching and administration at a number of institutions, Baruch, Mercy, Westchester Community, Orange County Community, and Lehman. In addition, you've had interspersed interesting non-academic positions along the way. Let's take them one by one. You spent almost 3 years with the Committee on Social Action in York, Pennsylvania. Please tell us about that work.
Okay, I was working a lot with my dad, and I was his assistant, and I was able to do some things for the in Harrisburg at the state capitol. And what we did there was to make known some of the deeds that Richard Allen, who was the founder of the African Methodist Church, what he did, and what he did in Pennsylvania. And we were able to have a famous Pennsylvanians room, and in that room we started it with Richard Allen. So it was a nice experience to study the history of how he interacted in the, I think it was the yellow fever at the time. Outburst in Philadelphia at the time, and all that he did at that time to make things better for people. And so it was a historical situation where we learned about the founding of Richard Allen, the triumph of Richard Allen, so to speak. And we put it up out there for people to see and know, and especially the young people.
Then 6 years after that, you joined AT&T, my wife Barbara's first employer, for a little over a year, and that seemed to be the complete switch because that was in the information systems area. What did that job entail?
Well, my brother encouraged me to come because they wanted a teacher because they were going to have a training system, and they wanted a teacher to take over the training system. So he encouraged me to come to AT&T and be there when they opened up the training system. So I was there for the training system, but the big training system. I did run training classes and on-the-job training, and I had assigned schedules for people to go into the library and to study there. But the big thing happened was that they were going to have a call center, but they didn't have it in it was supposed to be there in New Jersey when I was working in New Jersey, but they moved it to Florida. And so I didn't travel to Florida. But that was the whole thing that
did we have dead air there? Did I lose you for a moment?
Are we okay now?
We are, yes.
Hello?
Then after returning to academia for a few years, you joined Greenberg Graham for 6 months. What was involved there?
I was there as an administrative assistant in helping the principal. And learning what it was to be a principal from a female point of view, you know, the differences how a female takes on the principalship of a school as opposed to how a male. So I was observant to of that, you know.
And then the bigger surprise to me, you followed in your father's footsteps, spending 12 years as an associate pastor in the Bethel Church in New York. What brought on this change, and did you have to be ordained to function in this position?
Yes, I was ordained, and I was ordained, yes. And I had to go and get a master's degree. I had to go back to a master's degree in divinity, so I went back to school for that. And knowing that I had been in this kind of society all along, and then finding out more about it, you know, by being in the church with my dad and knowing more about the community building and so forth and so on. But it was a part of my life all along, but just getting into the makings of it was interesting. And,
my brother had the master's in the religious education or in religious school at the Drew, and he was most of the way to the PhD when he had some disagreement with the administration about the language requirement. And since he already had tenure at Caldwell College, he didn't pursue taking the test over. So what were your duties at Bethel?
I worked with the congregation I was under two different pastors, and my duties were mostly with the young people under the first pastor, and they were just more general under the second pastor. And I did a lot more.
No.
I think I did a lot of community. The first pastor had me to go in his stead to a number of different community meetings and a number of different engagements. He would ask me to go instead, and he would, you know, might have another engagement somewhere else. So there were a lot of things he asked me to do in his stead.
Now, when your father was ordained, I would suspect that women could not become ministers in the Methodist Church. Is that true?
Well, my father told me, I heard him say that. What happened with my father realized I was going to enter the ministry, and I didn't enter until after he had passed, but he realized it before he passed. And he said to my mom, well, what happened was when my brother and I were young, we went to Wilberforce University with our parents, and they were visiting. They had met there, so they took us there to see where they went to school. And my father went to see who was the president of the seminary. And so it happened to be Bishop Reverdy C. Ransom. And Reverdy C. Ransom asked my father to if he could meet the children, his children. He found out that my parents had two children, and he wanted to meet them. So my brother and I went to, he wanted to pray for us. That's what happened. He wanted to meet us, and he wanted to pray for us. So he prayed for us. We had to, and my brother and I remember this quite well, we had to kneel down, and he was a very tall, gaunt man, very tall. And he was all dressed in a long black robe with a white tunic and a hat with a tassel, and he prayed for us. He had great big hands, and here we are. We're maybe 7 and 8 years old, and he prays for us. And then after he prays, he tells our parents. He says one of them is going to enter the ministry, but I don't know which one. And so I think we both had a kind of life with the ministry, because my brother had a very big following wherever he went, and he was much an organizer, and he was even a counselor in terms of saving people's marriages and so forth and so on. And he was very comical, but sometimes he would say Do I have a shingle outside my door that says counselor? But anyway, I was the one who entered, and I think my father and I would hear them talking. So we were young at that time, and they were on the way back in the car. They were saying, which one do you think it's going to be? I don't know, but which one do you think it's going to be? And so when I was a teenager, I remember hearing my father. I was in another room, and I heard him pick up on this conversation. He says, I think it's going to be Annette, but they treat women so bad in the ministry. And then he said, but she'll be all right. And so that's what happened. They did treat women very badly. And I think it's coming more to light how women are treated in the ministry, and not just in one denomination, but throughout all of the denominations, women are not treated that well in the ministry. And I think every woman has a tale to tell.
Director of my Episcopal church for the last 16 years has been a woman. She recently accepted a position in Long Island as a canon of a mission. So we're in the process of looking for a new rector in the Episcopal church. But it's very interesting because I was for years in a Roman Catholic church where a woman cannot be a priest or the deacon. And when my brother was taking courses to be a deacon, my sister-in-law went to every course with him, but she couldn't be ordained. So, so that's interesting. For a year and a half, while still in your church function, you also served as a consultant to the Hudson River Healthcare. What was that about?
Well, that was very nice. That was very interesting because it prepared me for the transition into, I guess you call it, becoming a senior citizen. They had me to work with the seniors. And I think I didn't like the idea at first, but it was very interesting, and I appreciated it because it did help me to look at what the transition is all about as we move across the years from adulthood into that senior stage.
And so let's go back to your academic life. What courses did you generally teach?
Mostly language arts, creative writing. I taught some creative writing. I taught composition, taught literature, but mostly composition and expository writing.
What kept you moving away from academic life and then returning?
I don't really think I ever left it. I just kind of added other things along with it. It's something there are certain things that you don't really leave. They just enter into whatever else you're doing, and then they're there all the time. So, and I think teaching is like that. Teaching, you can be involved in so many other things and still hone your teaching skills.
Yes, that's absolutely true. Let's get to your writing. Has it been going on throughout your life, or is it the recent development, or?
Well, if I really go back to the first, incident that may have sparked my writing, I was a child in Georgia and playing out in the heat and the hot sun, and then I had a playmate, and what we would do when we got really hot would be go get some water, go get a cold drink of water. So there was a refrigerated water fountain in the church there in Georgia, and so when we wanted to go get the water, I would say, we can go here and get it, and we'd go into the church, and we'd get the water, and we'd come right out. And then one day the playmate said to me, I took her in the church so we could get our water and come right back out, she said, well, what's behind that door? She wasn't somebody who actually went to church. But she said, what's behind that door? And so I showed her what was behind that door. Well, I want to see what's behind that door, and I want to see what's behind that door. And so essentially we ended up in the office, my father's, the pastor's office, the church office. and there was a big black typewriter in there. And she says to me, I dare you to touch it. And she said, what is that? I said, it's a typewriter. She said, well, I dare you to touch it. So I touch it and hit a key. And so she said, well, I dare you to touch it again. I'll do it again. And so I did it again. And so she said, well, I really dare you to touch it again. Do it some more. And so I'm there typing. And my father hears the typewriter. He's the parsonage is nearby. So he comes over to see who's in the office on the typewriter. And he says to me, let me show you how to put the paper in the typewriter. So I learned how to put the paper in the typewriter. But after that, my father bought me a typewriter. That Christmas, I got a typewriter. So I think that might have helped me with writing, because not only did he get me a typewriter, he had me one of the teenagers in the class who had was taking typing, or one of the teenagers in the church who was taking typing, would come to teach me how to type. So I learned all about the home role with how to type, ASDF, space, JKL, semicolon. So I learned to type, and then, as I said, I got this typewriter for Christmas. So that was part of what happened. And then I think in seventh grade, I had this teacher who had me to have an assignment with finding an anthology and doing 20 poems in that. And that was another spark. I loved that assignment. That was a wonderful assignment. I got my parents involved with me. They were thrilled with that assignment because they had poems of their favorite poems that they wanted me to include in that anthology. So I think it just kind of stirred. And then all the way through school, there were teachers who told me, I want you to write. You can write. Be in charge of this literary magazine. And I never did. But they said, you're a good writer, and you should be in charge of this. We want you to do a literary magazine. But I didn't do that with them. But later, I think I did. I certainly got involved with Gwendolyn Brooks when she gave me a project to do an autobiographical poem, and I thought that was a challenge, and I hope to get that published before too long.
And you're still working on that?
Yes.
I
put it away for a while, and I'm pulling it out, and I said, well, it's got to be past time to have it, you know, finished.
Well, you've been reading it to good reviews to the various writers groups, so obviously it's still, you're moving along with it. You also had written for some publications because I saw on your resume that you wrote an article in 1973 about Gwendolyn Brooks, and could you. So you were writing some publication all the way back over 40 years ago. So have you been writing for publication since, or is the poetry the first time that you're getting back to it?
Well, 40 years or so ago, I was doing literary criticism, and I was in the Grail Research did some contemporary literary criticism. And people, and I'm listed in there somewhere, but I haven't done that much in the way of literary criticism for publication. Of course, I do it as I read and write. I'm constantly doing it, but now it's not. It's mostly writing. I don't know that I'll do that much in the way of essays anymore. But who knows? You know, some things are suited to essays. I'm working now also on a poem about the Statue of Liberty, which I think says a lot about the American situation when we look at how that statue, that first gift, that gift from France was treated, how they sent back the first model because here she was with a chain, here she was an as an African American person or a runaway slave, and they sent it back, and she ended up being a very different figure in terms of facial features. But I think that says, and I'm looking at that to see what that says about us as a nation and how that might have been different had we accepted a different model. I think there would have been a very different country had we accepted that first model that came over from France.
Now, is that going to be your focus, or is your main focus on the autobiographical poem?
Oh, it's autobiographical, but I think I'm doing a series of poems about America. And do you
plan to submit them and to publish them?
Well, possibly, because I've gotten three or four poems, and maybe this one about the Statue of Liberty is going to be another one, and maybe that will grow. And I also have some poetic sermons. I have some sermons that are poems, and I want to do something with those. I have a set of in terms of what I want to publish, I want to publish maybe 10 or 12 sermons that are poetic sermons. And I want to also publish my mother's letters. My mother was, during World War II, had a lot of letters from soldiers. And I want to publish those. And that's one of my... And then I had started a book with my dad, which I probably should try to finish. Although we were alternating chapters, but he's passed before we got very far. But I can certainly put out what we did do and perhaps maybe what I think he would have done in some of those other chapters. So I do have some projects. Those are some of my projects, and certainly my poem, autobiographical poem, is among them. But those are some of the projects I have.
Do you have a timetable laid out to finish the autobiographical poem?
Well, I should, but I must do it soon. I probably will have a due date, a deadline. I will impose a deadline on myself, but I haven't done it yet.
Let's speak about the process for a moment. How do you write? Do you write every day? Do you write at certain times? Do you write when the spirit moves you? Do you write as Vinnie D'Aquino does in the middle of the night? Do you have any set process, or is it depending on what else is going on in your life at the time?
It has to depend on whatever else. I think every writer's dream is to have this time that we can just devote to writing, but life invades on that time quite a bit. But I've done all of those things. I have had a certain time when my life allowed me to have a certain time. I've gotten up in the middle of the night when the poems came in the middle of the night or the message came in the middle of the night. So I've gone through those different things, but life is taking charge over some of the things that have to happen first. But ideally, I would like to have a schedule where I work a certain number of hours every day with my writing.
What's next for you? Just the concentration on the writing, or do you have other projects in mind?
Well, I think I have certainly five or six writing projects that I should finish. And I don't know that they would invade and keep me from doing anything else. So I don't think I'm going to close doors. I'm going to open doors rather than close them.
Okay. We've covered a lot of bases tonight in a fairly short time. What else would you like the audience to know about Dinette Shams?
Well, I'm always striving, I had a motto that came from my Latin teacher, and that was to make the world better and more beautiful simply because you have lived, and certainly that's been a part of that. And my parents also, my father gave me, has a passage of scripture that he kind of left with me whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue and if there be any praise, think on these things. So having lofty thoughts makes me feel that I can have lofty goals and results in life.
And you mentioned the... Go ahead.
And my mother also had this adage, if you don't have anything good to say, keep your mouth shut.
That's very difficult in today's political climate. you mentioned earlier that you see what's going on now in remembering to what you went through, and you see some parallels. That must be a terrible shock to you when everything's been... And seemingly, no matter if it's too slow or it's not, but it seemed like a progression through the Civil Rights Acts and Fair Employment and other things. And all of a sudden now, to see white supremacists out in the street, and it's become almost acceptable, other than the fact that they're smart enough to cover their face. How do you react to this? Is it more depressing to you as a woman of color who's coming through this before, and we seem to be on the right path, and all of a sudden, and we had the black president, and we even had conservative people like Jack Kemp, who was for John McCain, saying, "Isn't this a wonderful country? See what it shows." And all of a sudden, it seems to be not just slowing down, but going in the other direction. How do you handle it?
I think it's a little bit of disappointment, but then there's the part that says you've got to overcome, you know, maybe that American or that racial or thing that says we've got to overcome.
Yes. And do you think we will, though? I think we just had a technical problem because Annette disappeared on me. But we were at the end of the conversation anyhow. I think she was a terrific guest, and I'd like to thank her for it. And as I mentioned, she's been attending the various writing groups that I mentioned earlier in the Hudson Valley. And she's been an inspiration to me and to others there. So thank you again. And send any comments or questions to me about the show to johnmack13 at gmail.com, and join me next week for my interview with Sarah Bracy White. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, and there haven't been enough of them this year, see ya, and put it in a book. And she's back. I don't know to what happened, but I was just thanking you, Annette, and I was saying you must have some technical difficulty because you disappeared on me.
Well, yes, I'm sorry, but I didn't know how that happened.
Is there anything you want to add to the points you're making about the need for us to overcome? Other than it was a song of the civil rights time. I mean, shouldn't we reach some time that we don't have to keep overcoming the hate and bigotry in at least this country, but really in the world? Do you see that coming in our lifetimes?
That's a good question. We can't help but hope for it. We can't help but hope for it. And strive for it, and do all that we can to happen. This is a setback, certainly, but we've been through setbacks with racially, and as a race we have. And it didn't, you know, one of the young people said to me, when we were going through all of that in the 60s and people were... nonviolent marches and so forth and so on. One of them said to me, "Well, didn't you hate each other?" And there was no hatred, and the hatred didn't It wasn't a thing of hatred. No one felt hatred. We weren't happy about the situation, but hatred didn't exist. And I don't know that hatred should exist now.
I would disagree. I would say that the large majority of protesters did not have hate. I think that some extremists on the black side did, and I can understand it because of the way that they were treated. But I also think there was tremendous hate shown in Birmingham and other places where you turn police dogs on children and electrical prods. I think that was an indication of hate by the people that were protesting it. Now, a lot of people thought that was what turned a lot of the white people in the North seeing things like that, dogs going after children, and they were embarrassed and mortified by it. But I think the people that were doing things like that, or they were lynching people, had to hate. Maybe it was the good guys that didn't hate, but certainly the other team did, I think, don't you?
Well, now, I had a cousin who was there in Birmingham when the dogs came, and she was, I think, maybe 12 or 13 at the time. And she told me that she felt that was one day she could kill somebody. That was one day she felt that she really could kill somebody. But it wasn't a thing that lingered with her, you know. It was there, and it left. You understand
okay.
what I'm saying? So it didn't eat on her. It didn't eat her up. But
it was rage rather than hate, I guess. Yeah, yeah. Well, I can understand that too. But when we have people talking about anti-Semitic things on one side, calling Jews names. And on another side, lynching people and turning dogs on them and everything. I would think that at least don't do all of that anymore. But once we have people marching in the streets with Nazi flags, to one of the poems that I wrote had to do with the president saying that there were good people on both sides. I think that is. As soon as a good citizen got out in the street to march under the Nazi flag, he was no longer a good citizen. He was an enemy of the United States of America who lost millions of people in World War II that was brought on by the Nazis. So maybe you're more optimistic than I am, but to me, that has me very upset.
Well, it is upsetting, but I think there is something in the spirit that we've dealt with it so long that there's a way to overcome it, and I'm not sure exactly how we've overcome it, but I think it has to do with loving self to the extent that there's a way, you know, that helps to overcome it. Because we've gone through a lot of, and we're still going through. And we wonder how can that, you know, and it also comes from having a good faith, having faith. And I think faith brings us through our religious roots, our grounding, being grounded in knowing that there is something that can transform and turn all of that around. And it can happen in an instant. And I think some of that is
I agree, and I'm very happy that you're so hopeful. Maybe it will rub off on me. Well, but thank you very much for your time tonight, and it was
thank
a wonderful
you.
Show.
Thank you very much.
And I will soon, and I will take us off once again with the Eagles. Amazon, play Take It Easy.
Thank you.
Thank you again. And thanks again, Jeanette, and good night, everybody. Thank you very
much.
Good
night. Good night. Thank you.